Alexander Coburn, one of America's best-known radical journalists, was born in Scotland and grew up in Ireland. An Oxford graduate, he was an editor at the Times Literary Supplement and the New Statesman before becoming a permanent resident of the United States in 1973. Coburn wrote on the press and politics for the Village Voice. That's where I first encountered his column, Press Clips. And all through the 1980s, he was a regular columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He co-edits with Jeffrey St. Clair the lively Counterpunch newsletter. That's counterpunch.com. And is the author of several books, author, co-author of Corruptions of Empire, Al Gore, A User's Manual. Yeah, that title worked. The Fate of the Forest, Developers, Destroyers, and Defenders of the Amazon, and the best-selling White, The Press, Drugs, and the CIA. So Mr. Coburn's going to speak for 35, 40 minutes or so, and then we'll open it to question and answer, and we look forward to having an engaging and enlightening evening. Alexander Coburn.
Water ready. How are you all? Nice to see you. We're at a not entirely unfamiliar moment in American history, with shouts of triumph that another devil is being laid low, that after much uncertainty, force of arms has prevailed. The subdued locals are greeting the liberators in the streets, and a new era is about to dawn. Nor have the events of the last year been unfamiliar to anybody who's lived through the last few decades, or even if they had the memory going back to the late 19th century, or if you're talking about the extermination of threats of terrorism to the beginnings of the wars on the native populations of the Americas. If anyone wants to see a precursor of the rhetoric about the devil Saddam, you might want to go and look at the winning of the West by President Theodore Roosevelt, where many of the racist constructs that we've become familiar with in its most recent episode are laid out for you. I was here in Chapman in the late 80s when we were consumed with a different part of the world, Central America. And the people who have been agitating for peace and for a peaceful solution at that time were struggling against the interventions launched in the beginning under the presidency of Jimmy Carter and then in the Reagan era. The rhetoric of threat, as promulgated by an administration and retailed by the major media, doesn't vary that much. It varies in nuance. The net effect is that the United States is confronted by a terrifying enemy with the capacity, despite the seeming huge disproportion in size and power, to bring us to our knees. Earlier today, in a class, I was recalling there have been moments when it has become positively surreal. One of the great threats of the Reagan era was the tiny island of Grenada, with a population far inferior to the population of Orange. This little nation held America virtually a hostage, not because it had many arms, it didn't, not because it had much economic clout, it had none of that. By the provision of geography, it was accused of lying athwart crucial sea lanes. Some of the younger people in this crowd may not even give this credit, but I can assure you it was seriously discussed in the major newspapers of the time that somehow a Soviet-guided Grenada would cause vital oil tankers from the Middle East to be diverted, perhaps sunk, and America would soon be thrown to its knees. That was a good one. It was a real stretch, but it worked for a while. Central America, again, I was remembering, there was a time when the Sandinistas were going to take their army, their vast Soviet-trained army, march north through Mexico and into Texas, advancing on crucial conurbations such as Dallas-Fort Worth, maybe even as far as New Orleans. This again was promoted as a very serious threat. In each case, what happened is the creation of these devil figures. International law was flouted. The Charter of the United Nations was torn up by the US administration of the time. Savage and terrifying punitive wars were launched against Central America. The Carter administration began by hiring Argentinian torturers to organize the Contras. The torturers themselves had been originally coaxed into being partly due to Henry Kissinger. There's a real continuity here. Wars of embargoes were launched against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Long, relatively silent wars, such as the sanctions which lasted the whole of the way through the 90s in Iraq. A lot of the wars that the US launch attain their full savagery without a battery of press, embedded journalists, headlines on CNN. It's a slow, relentless attrition of standards of living, where kids die in childbirth, die when they're young, old people die quicker. A social level of malnutrition and afflicted health and living conditions, lousy water, poor food, economic degradation, slowly and relentlessly grind a nation down. That's a real war. We've been seeing a real war across the Third World for decade after decade. About half the world's population live on about 50 cents a day. In Latin America, after two decades in which the neoliberal model has been touted against any other model of development, above all against a model of development represented by, let's say, Cuba, has brought an entire continent to its knees. Almost every country throughout Latin America is run by a kleptocracy. Under pressure from the IMF, public services have been ground down. Public health systems have been sold off to private companies. Public lands, as in Mexico, the ejidos, have been given over to private ownership. With the result that even the right wing in Brazil now say it is time that we throw off the rule of the IMF. I'm sorry too. I was just rising to a climax of oratory. Don't do that again. The rule of the IMF. It's time to throw that aside. We are reaching, if you look at the overall picture, the Iraq war is just a tiny chapter in a struggle where it shifts from location to location across the globe. But it's really always about the rich, the propertied, the affluent chunk of the world exercising continued domination over the poorer parts of the world who have made efforts to capture and retain their national resources. We need make no apologies for the regime of Saddam Hussein, but the nationalization of the Iraqi Petroleum Company did produce a measure of social wealth for more Iraqis than had ever happened before in their history, particularly in the 80s. There was a time, 20, 30 years ago, when everybody in Iraq could enjoy access to free health care. Iraq was a vicious police dictatorship, but it also had a measure of a welfare state. What was the real consequence of when America lured Saddam to the feeling that he could attack Kuwait with impunity in 1990? The sanctions were imposed, the bombs were dropped to destroy infrastructure, all of which are war crimes. They hanged a German general, Seyss Inquart, after World War II for breaching the Dutch dikes and causing widespread famine in Holland. They hanged him. The Pentagon planned deliberately the onslaught on the water systems of Iraq and the power systems of Iraq to degrade the civilian population, and by the same standard, people from the Pentagon under which should have been in the dock for war crimes and strung up. So when you look at the larger picture, that is the real war. And it's a war that the press have paid almost no attention to. Not on a year-by-year basis. We've seen now we have the troops in Baghdad. We'll have maybe a provisional government, the Chalabi government. You'll probably have Iraqi opposition regrouping, fighting a guerrilla war. This could go on for year after year. What you undoubtedly will see, though, which you could see if you visited, is the social situation for people in Iraq getting steadily worse. How many people now, how many stories do you now read about what Kosovo is like? A war of liberation of the middle 90s. There was no, by the way, UN approval for that. The UN wasn't even consulted. People talk about Bush flouting the UN Security Council. He did. There's no mistaking about it. It's not the first time. Decade after decade, when the UN hasn't clicked its heels, the US has said, we're going ahead anyway. Nothing new. It's quite right to protest, but we're reenacting a same old scene. That's the real war. And it began after the Second World War, when there were two paths. The two paths were, could the Third World develop in a way that allowed it to get a decent price for its raw commodities, have access to international capital, have the materials and the resources to carve its destiny? All across the Middle East at that time, social reformers tried to inaugurate a new day. Iran, they tried to have land reform. What happened? The CIA assisted with a coup and installed the Shah. The Shah of Iran was finally overthrown, which produced the Ayatollah Khomeini. Iraq had a reform movement. What happened? The CIA helped Saddam Hussein to power, gave him the list, all the list that had accumulated of progressive professionals across Iraq, and said, these are your enemies, and they were all exterminated. These are long, long wars. And what you have from the media is a flickering, brief, spasmodic interest, where everything is presented in caricature. What have we seen now? We've seen a kind of comic strip drama. First of all, you have Saddam Hussein, a brutal dictator. It's true. The worst dictator in the history of the world? No. An intolerable threat to the United States? Absolutely not. You have had the President of the United States claiming, despite all the findings of the UN teams, yes, there were weapons of mass destruction. Iraq had to disarm. Yes, Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were hand in glove. Yes, Iraq presented a real and present threat to the United States. did these claims receive adequate scrutiny in the press? Now, when we talk about the press, we can talk about two kinds of press. We can talk about the press as consumed by the vast majority of the citizens, the networks, AM radio, in which, of course, now levels of monopoly and control of the visual and sound spectrum are at staggering levels. Remember, back in the 1930s, there were debates about the airwaves being a public asset. We owned it, we the people. Decade after decade, the industry has made one encroachment after another until it was all wrapped up in the Telecommunications Reform Act. Whenever you see the word reform, you want to be real careful. Usually you can just do a straight transliteration. The Telecommunications Regression Act, Monopoly Act. So that now you have an outfit like Clear Channel Communications owning 800 radio stations, where people talk on these stations. You can drive across America and hear people talking in Albuquerque. They'll be talking about a traffic jam in downtown Albuquerque. It's all being put together back in Indiana. They're just making up little spots to make it sound as though they're regional. And, of course, you've got networks like CNN, part of the Time Life empire, battling it out for ratings and therefore advertising income with Fox, run by Rupert Murdoch. I don't think anyone who's watched the caricature unfold on these networks and the war, if you just watched that, you would not have the remotest idea of what political reality is. You would see a largely triumphalist procession. You would have no sense of what the reality of war is. War, not just as was even photographed by Al Jazeera. What are 20 dead children who've been killed with a cluster bomb look like close up? If you watched Al Jazeera, you could probably see it. What happened to Al Jazeera? Al Jazeera has been hailed as, at last, the Arab world produced a relatively free TV station, criticizing Arab dictatorships. Is it Arab societies who've killed and attacked Al Jazeera correspondents? No. Al Jazeera was bombed by the US in Kabul, because it was carrying tapes put out by Osama bin Laden. And only yesterday, the Al Jazeera offices in Baghdad had two rockets fired on by a US plane and the chief correspondent killed. This was after Al Jazeera had gone to the Pentagon and said, "This is our office. This is where it is on Tigris, on the river, beside the river Tigris. This is where we are. Please do not fire on us." And the Pentagon said, "Oh, no, we won't." That was twice that they did that, and yesterday the guy was killed. So who doesn't like free press? Does that mean, I said, there are two kinds of press? There is the now monopolized, flag-wagging, ratings-hunting, mainstream press. There is the vast extent, and I think we can be more optimistic here, of the unofficial press. And here I think the situation has got better. Why is it that across this country and across the world, we saw people turn out in unparalleled numbers demonstrating against this war? A peace demonstration that had huge effects, empowering the Turkish people to demonstrate, which in turn allowed the Turkish parliament, in a historic vote, to say, no, you cannot use northern Turkey for a launching off point for invasion. I think it's the power of unofficial media, which you can look across a spectrum from areas that take, let's say, Democracy Now!, the Pacifica stations, that get some community FM stations, that get feeds on listservs on the internet. I think the internet, which I used to be somewhat cynical about its claims, has had a huge effect on the general level of knowledge if you want to get it. If you want to get it. Anyone now can open up a laptop and get reports from around the world, detailed reports of what you're not reading in the mainstream. If you read alternative press, or even if you from time to time would get a hint, an op-ed, even an interview, let's say, by Peter Jennings on ABC, of some sense of what the reality of this was all about. Why was the United States obsessed with Saddam Hussein, a vastly impoverished country which had been driven relentlessly back into the bottom basement of the third world? Why was it being invented as a threat? What were the reasons? Was it about oil? After all, Iraq has the second largest reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. Was it an effort hatched in collusion with Likud hawks in Israel to rearrange the chairs in the Middle East, finish off Iraq as a challenge to Israeli interests, change regimes in Syria, maybe attack Iran? Was it larger than that? Simply an assertion that 10, 15 years after the end of the Cold War, God, really the end of Alexander Coburn, that's a trap. After the Soviet Union had fallen, to say, look, we are the undisputed rulers of the world. And we place Europe on notice. France, Germany, you are not to present yourselves as a rival to us in terms of dominance of the planet. Was that the game? Anyone following these would see people giving. Was it because they wanted to pay for oil in dollars and not in euros? You can read 100 different reasons. The answer, a mixture of all of them. People go to war for a mixture of reasons. There's no single strand you can say, this is it. But it is quite clear that an extreme faction in the making of US policy, which has been present and maneuvering across the last 30, 40 years, has attained absolute dominance. We are at an extremely perilous moment. Extremely perilous moment now, in terms of really alarming possibilities. The world is an extremely fragile place. You only have to think for a minute of North Korea, which has believed ever since the Axis of Evil speech, it is next in line. North Korea is right there above the DMZ. It has the capacity, fairly rapidly, to destroy a lot of South Korean, the heartland of the South Korean economy, which is a major player in the world economy. Many strategists believe, looking at what happened to U.S. tactical forces in Iraq, even in Iraq across 3 weeks, that in the different terrain of Korea, the only way a similarly swift victory could be attained would be by the use of nuclear weapons. And for those with a sense of history, you can go back to the Korean War and discover that there was a substantial faction inside the U.S. High Command which wanted to use nuclear weapons, MacArthur being prime among them, nuclear weapons on Korea at that time. Matthew B. Ridgway, a general, threatened to resign when the Americans Dulles wanted to use nuclear weapons on Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam in 1954. There have been some very mad and dangerous people on the levers of power for a very long time, but now I believe if you look across the Bush administration, you are looking at a collectivity of rashness and of fanaticism, which is truly intimidating. People sometimes say it would have been exactly the same, and I speak as a guy who co-wrote a pretty tough book about Al Gore, it would have been the same under Gore. Actually, I don't think so. I do not think so. I think the posture towards the end, you would have been different. I think the timbre would have been different. I do not quite believe we would have been in the same situation. But here we are. We are in this situation. And so the question is, what can be done about it? What is our situation? We are looking at a Congress which is almost utterly cowed. Maybe there are 20 to 30, sometimes less, people on the radical end of the Democratic Party on the Hill who will vote for the peace. Not many of them. You've got Democratic primaries coming up where it's possible that candidates like Dean or even Kerry will say there must be a path of negotiation, there must be a path of reason, but they'll be awfully timid about it. We are at a moment when the US economy itself is extremely fragile for reasons unconnected with the war. It cost a lot of money, it's true. But now a lot of established banking houses in New York are refusing to say the economy is out of a recession. And if there's a real collapse in housing prices, which people have been borrowing against to finance debt, which has been keeping the economy going in the trenches of the American shopping malls, the whole thing could fall apart. These moods of war, when you get to a war, when you look at coverage of war, reality flies out the window. I was born in 1941, just before the Battle of Britain. In fact, the house I grew up in was destroyed by a German V1. Now, if you look back on the accounts of it, indomitable Britain, Churchill saying we shall fight them on the beaches, some of the great myths of war of the 20th century, all were completely untrue. For those who like little anecdotes, the Churchill speech, we shall fight them on the beaches, as heard by people around the world, wasn't Churchill's voice. It was an actor whose usual job was to read out the voice of Larry the Lamb. Churchill refused to re-record his speech for the BBC, and they hauled in the guy who did Larry the Lamb to imitate Churchill. Here's a little byway of history for you. A lot of the English people were extremely defeatist, leaving London in very large numbers to wander around the New Forest because of the force of the bombing. The reality of war and the press presentation of war drift miles apart. I think people say, what can be done? It begins always with where you are and what you do. It begins with demonstrations and organizing. It begins with linking for people, domestic and foreign. When I was driving down to San Francisco from Petrolia up in Humboldt County, I went through Willits, and at the Alternative Environmental Center, they had a sign, tax cuts for the rich, and guess who's fighting in Iraq? That was a pretty good sign, I thought. And it represented what, after all, is a class war at home. As always, America's wars are fought by people who are, some of whom qualify for assistance. They're paid so badly. They're obviously receiving training. At a moment when Bush is cutting veterans' benefits and handing out some of the largest tax breaks in the history of tax breaks to the rich. Actually happening at this minute. You have people of the troops over there fighting for the energy empire, while the representatives of the rich at home vote away support for them and give money to the rich. That's a way you can get the interest and attention of people who would say, why aren't you supporting our troops? Speaking to people in a way that brings home, what are the real reasons for war? Now, will they discover weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? If they possibly can, and if they can't, they'll probably make them. And they'll put them there. Already they've discovered them three times. It won't be hard. It won't be hard to find a weapon of mass destruction. And after all, the US has got plenty of weapons of mass destruction. Who wants to spare a few to put in some bunker that Saddam Hussein might have once inhabited. The efforts to justify after the event are great, but not that great. They'll say after a while it wasn't really about weapons of mass destruction. They can make these reasons and throw them away in a day. Right after they had said Saddam Hussein might be in a bunker under a restaurant, they send in a plane, they kill 9 people with rockets who lived in houses next door. And then when people say, well, did you kill him? They say, well, we don't really care if we did or not. Osama bin Laden, who's he? Who's he, they say. He's not really the issue. There's something so contemptuous about the way they pick up a reason, hold it up to the people, say, look at this. Look at this. This is why you should be frightened. And then when it's served a momentary purpose, toss it aside and bring up another one. And look at this. SARS. He started SARS. Someone started it. China. Everything bad starts in China. Made in China. SARS. For the richest country in the history of the planet, it's filled with very nervous people. Frightened as if it, any time the mouse comes out from under the tablecloth, it's up on the chair. Let's nuke it. Why is this society so hysterical? Most of the people on the planet live under conditions of, you know, endless grinding privation. Life's a struggle. It's a struggle to get water. It's a struggle to get to work. Well, it's a struggle for people here to get to work very often, but, you know, fighting traffic on the 405 isn't exactly the same as a lot of conditions in the world today. But this country thrives on the rhetoric of panic. And a lot of the media exists to foment panic and fear and apprehension. So much of our culture is premised on the idea of filling you with apprehension. The police dramas, etc. What did we learn? What did we learn during this war? We learned that now the US is triumphantly ahead in the world championship on the number of people per capita in prison. Triumphantly. No doubt about it. China, once a threat, gone. We won. We have over 2 million people passing through the justice system in penitentiaries, in jails, on parole, in halfway houses. The whole vast panoply. For black people, the chances of being arrested and going to prison are sometimes as high as 29%. This is incredible. You've got about 10% of African Americans permanently disenfranchised because they're classified as felons and they won't be able to vote. A threat. The culture of threat. So that the recognition of real threats gets more and more postponed. What are real threats? The real threat in the world, the real threat which prompts terror, is simple need, is poverty, is the visible sight of injustice across the world, which causes millions of hearts to beat in fury and anger amid their misery. That's a threat. Since 9/11, has that threat been mitigated? Has it been allayed in any way? Absolutely not. Supposing after 9/11, someone had said, that, you know, one of the problems is this planet, the imbalance between wealth and poverty is so vast that it's almost unimaginable. And we are inaugurating, even though we are launching a war on terror, fine, you've got to say it, launch a war on terror, all you will, we are also launching a war on what? We are launching a mighty Marshall Program to bring money and investment to the third world. Would that have diminished the threat of terror? Of course. Supposing you'd said, what is it something that burns in the mind of the Arab world, of Islam and etc.? The injustice done to Palestinians on a daily basis. Supposing you'd said, we will try and restore a path to peace. Absolutely not. Give Sharon the green light to nibble away at the West Bank, put more settlers there, roll into refugee camps, to say virtually nothing when an heroic American, Rachel Corrie, is run over by a bulldozer. Some of the bravest people on the planet today are the people in the International Solidarity Campaign on the West Bank. That would have reduced terror. You can just tick off time after time how you would bring, I know this place is, good catch, involved in the search for peace, how you would reduce the real risks of war. But we have seen a kindling, gasoline thrown on the tinder month after month since 9/11 in a way that's stupefying in its ignorant fanaticism. Will people, are there enough people here across the country who can say enough? I do not think, and this is anecdotal, you look at the opinion polls, they say 70% for the war, but you look at the specific questions underneath that overall number. You know, do you think Bush has reduced risks of terrorism? No. Do you think? And then you look at those questions, it's very different. Have I seen up where I live an orgy of, flag wagging, of beyond the simple fear that, you know, people in the troops that might get killed, beyond a feeling of, God, I got to support, and there are people over there and I got to support them. I'm talking about, middle America. No, I don't think so. I think vastly less than there was in 1991. Vastly less. I did not feel, intemperate fanaticism in people, and I've had plenty of chances to have debate and argument with people. Didn't feel like that to me. I have a feeling in this country there is a sense, even now there is a sense that there is an illegitimacy about this administration. I think the memory of Florida, the memory of what the Supreme Court did, those Republican justices did, has not gone away, particularly among African Americans, but in the society at large. There is a sense of disquiet at what happened. I think there is a sense of profound unease about the attributes, intellect, and capacity for governance of George Bush. Highly justified. Highly justified. A truly appalling commander-in-chief. Helen Thomas, a longtime Washington correspondent, you must have seen her in many a White House press conference, said he is the worst president in American history, and I think you can make a pretty good case for it. So, in every venue, one has to try and struggle for reason. One has to try and push forward in media to which one has access, in community groups. And again, there have been some changes. Labor, organized labor, actually came out against this war before it began. Which shows, as of 30 years ago, the idea of the AFL, of George Meany, coming out against a war would be inconceivable. Inconceivable. Not anymore. The texture of the labor movement has changed. People say, is there a magic recipe in the resistance to madness? No, there's not. It's always the same. Organizing in community groups, in coalitions, at every level. Trying to pressure or build up new outlets of expression. There's no secret way. But I do think in general that people, the incredible media blitz that we've just been experiencing, I don't think has deluded people entirely. I really don't. And the thing to remember is not to forget these places as they go by. People should go back to Nicaragua and say, what is the mathematics of what happened since the full weight of the American empire descended on one small country that was trying to adjust ownership of land, adjust the disproportion between rich and poor? In El Salvador, the FMLN just had a considerable triumph. Yugoslavia is a wasteland. They said that after the Soviet Union fell, the capitalist way would produce a prosperous and vibrant Russia. Instead of which, what have you got? A waste zone ravaged by the mafiosi and the oligarchs. One can't just forget the world and accept the caricature. One has to try and always remind oneself and remind people of what the reality is. And to see what has dominated our consciousness has been put into our consciousness for months now as the supreme fight against Saddam. See that as, in a historical context, as an episode of a familiar story, a familiar tragedy, but one which will be with us always, but which we have to contest. Thank you.